Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a successful British novelist and lyricist, probably best known for writing the words to seven tracks on Pink Floyd's number one album, The Division Bell. Alongside this, the former journalist has written a number of critically acclaimed short stories and novels, the latest of which is A Theatre for Dreamers, a story of discovery set against the beautiful backdrop of Hydra, the Greek island fabled for its hedonism in the 1960s. The book was widely hailed as one of the best novels of 2020. Polly Sampson, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you, Georgina. It's lovely to talk to you again.
And indeed, to talk to anybody at this stage.
Yes.
Polly, you've been on this show before and we've spoken often at sort of festivals around the country, but you have such a fascinating backstory, your multicultural background, for instance. And I wondered if you could just refresh our memories about your upbringing.
Oh, yes. I suppose I'd need to start with my parents, who were both refugees to England in 1938, although separately. My father came on the Kinder transport from Hamburg, and my mother came on a slow boat from China. She'd been born in Shanghai to a Chinese father and an English mother, and it was the time of the Japanese invasion, and so they were sent back to England. Her mother was very young. She had three small children, couldn't cope at all, had nowhere to go. I think they spent the first few nights in a Salvation Army shelter. And eventually her mother, my grandmother, put the children in a Dr. Bernardo's home. And my mother had a sort of terrible childhood, unlike my father, who had, you know, very close-knit Jewish family, many of them already in England, doctors and lawyers. And, you know, they were sort of welcomed and their lives were much easier than my mother's and her siblings' lives, which were far more uncertain. At 16, my mother married one of General Chinnault's Flying Tigers in order to get back to China because she wanted to find her father. And the upshot of that was that she arrived in Red China. She left her husband in Hong Kong and they didn't know what to do with her. So they put her in the Red Army and she became a major in the Red Army and ended up staying for 10 years. She then married a British journalist who was reporting on the Korean War from the North Korean side. And when they needed to leave China, the British government at that point were very reluctant to allow him back in the country. There was calls for him to be tried for treason with unfounded investigation into the treatment of prisoners of war in North Korea, which actually was then fought and he was found to be completely innocent. But they, meanwhile, were stateless and had to go and live in East Berlin. My father, biological father, worked on the same newspaper as Alan Winnington, the Daily Worker, as it then was, and was sent to East Berlin to try and help the campaign to reinstate Alan Winnington's passport. And he brought my mother and their children, two boys, back to England. They fell in love. I was the result of their falling in love. And my sort of first 5 years was sort of slightly tricky, very tricky, as my mother moved between the East and the West, uncertain how to resolve this problem of having basically two husbands. And eventually, when I was seven, she decided to marry my father. And the man I called Daddy was actually Alan Winnington, and he stayed for the rest of his life in East Berlin. And we lived at that point, we moved from London and lived in the West Country. And so I had a very different sort of childhood from that point on, living first of all in the middle of nowhere in Cornwall and then later in Devon. So that's my parents. It takes a while.
Absolutely fascinating. And yeah, I mean, your mother wrote a book about it, didn't she?
Yes, Black Country to Red China. And in fact, I think my mother is 88 and she's writing a new book at the moment. And yeah, and Alan Winnington, of course, has written extensively. I mean, he's now dead. And yeah, so that was them.
But I mean, it's extraordinary because there is this generational thing. Your mother, you, and of course, your son has just had an incredibly successful memoir come out.
Yes, Featherhood. Yes, I suppose three generations. Mm. And of course, his father was also a writer. So I'm very, very proud of his first book. I mean, it's been wonderful. He's been locked down with us. And, you know, his book was written before COVID struck. My novel was written before COVID struck. I mean, neither of us, I don't think, or in common with so many people, would have been able to concentrate to write anything while, you know, our future's so uncertain. But it sort of did give us something to do while we were all locked down together, because, you know, although we couldn't go to literary festivals or into bookshops, and I think neither of us has ever met a reader in the flesh, which is an odd situation, we you know, the world adapted, and we did lots of online sort of talks about our books. We started something from here, from a barn here, called the Von Trapped family, because there were a few of us here, and we decided that we would do a sort of once a week kind of live stream, and that really kept us going. And I was sort of thinking this morning that had the books not been published, you know, in this year, it would have been much worse for us, because, you know, it gave us something else to think about, actually, which was that, you know, the books had to be published. We had, you know, we had publishers who were relying on us to do whatever we could. And it was a very, very welcome distraction, actually. Mm.
I mean, I watched a number of your Von Trapped family episodes. They were fabulous. And at this point, we should introduce that you're married to David Gilmour from Pink Floyd, and indeed have written a lot of his lyrics. And I remember once you telling me that some of it was written with an absolute fever. You were very unwell.
Yes, that was the beginning, at the beginning. I don't think I would have done it, actually, had I... I had glandular fever, and it was very early on in our relationship. And David at that point was in a studio with the other members of Pink Floyd making music. And he's always struggled with lyrics, and I would be lying in bed with a massive fever, and he'd come back and play me tracks, and, you know, and say, oh, what do you think? What do you think? And I'd say, well, it's lovely. And he'd sort of, we'd start talking about what the lyric might be. And, you know, he was writing down things I was saying, and then he would kind of present to me something and say, well, I think I could sing this. And at that point, I would kind of think, oh, God, really? No, I don't think so. And yeah, so well, just give it to me. Let me fiddle with it a bit. And that's really how it started, with the first sort of couple of tracks that I wrote with him. And then later on, I kind of, you know, once he'd recorded a couple, I kind of thought, well, actually, I can do this. This is extraordinary. Not something I'd ever set out to do. And I mean, now we write together, you know, all the time. But yes, that's how it started, with a fever.
How did your literary career start?
That started, I've always written that, you know, when people sort of say, how did you become a writer? I don't think I did become a writer, but I just didn't realise that the things that I wrote were in any way of interest to anyone else. And I worked in publishing. I worked at Jonathan Cape, and in the 80s, you know, anyone who was anyone seemed to be published either by Cape or by Faber. And, you know, it was quite sort of off-putting, the idea of ever showing anyone anything I'd written, given how great the list was. But someone who I'd worked with for a long time got to read a story I'd written and absolutely press-ganged me into entering it for a competition that The Guardian were running for unpublished writers. And so I sent it in and didn't think any more about it. And about 6 months later, ran into someone who said, oh, I didn't realise you wrote. I saw your name in The Guardian. And, you know, they'd had thousands of entries, and I was runner-up or shortlisted or something. And this friend had sort of seen it. And he said, oh, I kept it. And he sent it to me. And I was kind of sort of wonderful. And from my publishing days, I'd known the agent, now sadly departed, Ed Victor. And he'd always said to me, once I'd become a journalist, one day, you know, you're going to write a great novel and I'm going to be your agent. And I'd say, oh, yes, haha, you know, of course. And I ran into Ed around this time, and I said, oh, Ed, this extraordinary thing. I was shortlisted or runner up for this Guardian thing, and all these thousands of people entered. And he said, yes, I've always known that this would happen. And do you have more short stories? Maybe you should just start with a collection of short stories. And that's how it started. He sold them to Virago, and then he sold my first novel. And yeah, and after that, I didn't write in secret anymore.
And that first collection was Perfect Lives.
No, that was Lying in Bed.
Right.
It was published in 1999.
And from then followed your first novel.
So my first novel came out the following year. And the reason it came out the following year, I suffered from crippling lack of self-belief. And Virago, when they bought the stories, also bought, it was a two-book contract. It was the stories plus a novel. And I thought at the time that I was so sort of lacking in confidence. I imagined that the stories would come out and everyone would kind of be very down on them and I'd get terrible reviews. And, you know, I just had no sense that anyone would like them. And so I thought, well, I'd better get this novel written before the first book, the book of stories, comes out, because I will be so destroyed by people saying mean things about them, I'll never get the novel written. So I actually wrote the novel to the first draft in 6 weeks in this sort of panic. And the novel was finished before the Book of Stories came out and was published exactly a year after the Book of Stories. And thank goodness no one said anything horrible about the short stories. And and I felt fine after that. I didn't, my confidence was definitely improved by that experience.
I mean, they were all hugely lauded. And of course, The Kindness did incredibly well, which was your novel before this current one.
Yes, that was lovely. And I don't have that same feeling anymore, but it's taken a few books for me to sort of feel it's all going to be OK. It's all right. You can do this. And no one minds.
Not only do we not mind, but we have been looking forward to Theatre for Dreamers for such a long time. And, you know, it came at a time when we all were beginning to be locked down and all the rest of it. And suddenly you transported us to this amazing place. So tell us about Hydra as it was in the 1960s, because there is an extraordinary real-life cast of characters assembled there at the time.
Yes, the novel takes place primarily in 1960. What happened to Idra was that it's from the sort of middle 50s, and it wasn't the first time, actually, because there'd been a previous generation of writers who had been there. But there were a disparate group of about 10 people who had international artists and writers who had made it their home. And these people were not connected with each other. And sort of the king and queen of this group, who had arrived in 1955, were an Australian married couple of writers called Charmian Clift and George Johnston. And they had to write in order to put food on the table. They had three children. There was no messing around. And it was the same for the other people in the group. Later on in the 60s, the culture changed. And I think that it's partly that the drug culture changed. You know, in the 50s, you know, people would meet and they'd have an ouzo. But later on, I think it became somewhere. In fact, someone told me the other day that it was during the military junta. It was the one place where people could be and there would be a blind eye turned to anyone sort of doing drugs, because they liked to think that at least it was all in one place and that those sorts of people were all in one place. So it got very, very wild later on, and it became a place where people went with this idea of writing and being artists, but it became much more of a sort of hippie commune without a lot of work going on. But in the period that I was interested in, these people were living there because it was a cheap place to live where they could genuinely do their work. And it sort of, in a way, it became famous because it's where Leonard Cohen went. And he arrived in 1960. And in fact, like many people who came to the island, he spent his first few days there in the house of Charmian Clift and George Johnston. So my interest in it started with Charmian Clift, because I went just for a family holiday with no thought of writing about Hydra in, I think it was 2014. And while I was there, I found a much out of print memoir written by Charmian Clift about their life on Hydra called Peel Me a Lotus. And I just fell in love with her. I mean, she writes in an incredibly interesting way. She's got a very intimate voice. And I had to know more about her. So when I got home, I, you know, Googled her. And the first thing that comes up are these photographs of her with Leonard Cohen. Because, of course, that is the only thing that sort of remained of her, was that she had been there at the same time as him. Mm. And so in these sort of rather wonderful photographs, you see this whole group of people sitting with Leonard Cohen playing guitar, Charmian sitting next to him singing along, and some of them, her head is on his shoulder. And it just made me sort of wonder about all of them. And so I just sort of started idly kind of identifying the people in the photographs. And it just became an obsession, really. And, you know, a lot of them were writers and they all had published and unpublished sort of novels and diaries and letters and academic archives, left, right and centre. And actually the photographs that I'd seen that had first sort of hooked me after Charmian's memoir, it turned out that there were over 1,500 taken by a photographer called James Burke. And he had been living in Athens. He was he'd been a war correspondent at the same time as George Johnston. And they'd done a lot of travelling together in the Far East. And he was interested in this sort of burgeoning community. And so he had sold the idea to Life magazine of a photojournalism essay about this community. And that is why there are 1,500 photographs. And the only reason that I or anyone else has ever sort of come across those photographs is by quirk of fate, because Leonard Cohen is in them.
That's extraordinary. And I mean, another thing is that you've done, certainly me and I'm sure many other people, the most wonderful service by introducing us to the person, but also the work of Charmian Clift. Just, as you say, an extraordinary writer.
Yes, the most wonderful thing that has happened. I mean, when this book was published, I felt very downhearted. You know, I thought, that's it, that's the end. You know, no one is ever going to read this book, because, you know, it came out on the 2nd of April last year. You know, it was just after lockdown had happened. The bookshops all closed. I just thought, well, that's that. That's all those years of work and no one is ever going to read this novel. But as it turned out, it was just what everyone wanted, you know, to time travel and to go to a Greek island seemed to be exactly what people wanted to do. So that was good that the novel didn't just sort of slip away during this year. The other really wonderful and the really wonderful thing that's happened was that, so Charmian Clift has been out of print for, I think in this country for 20 years. And I very much wanted to get her back into print. And so in the acknowledgements, I put something like, you know, I acknowledge in advance any publisher with the taste and foresight to reissue the books of Charmian Clift. And this wonderful publisher called Muswell Press read my novel, and they've done just that. And they come out next week, and I've written the introductions, and they've got beautiful, beautiful covers. And I couldn't recommend them more highly. If anyone wants to travel to the 50s in Greece, you know, the world before mass tourism, with the best company, then I would thoroughly recommend those two books. Mm. One is, the first one is written, it was set in 1955 on the island of Kalymnos, where the family went for their first year in Greece, which was even more basic than Idra. And, you know, it's written almost with the eyes of an anthropologist, because she's looking at Greek society. And she's also a sort of powerful proto-feminist, way ahead of her years. And so she's looking at women's roles, and she has so much of interest to say, and she writes beautifully.
Mm. Now, as you say, of course, one of the reasons, or the main reason, that this was all documented was because Leonard Cohen was there. But in your book, your main protagonist is a teenager. She's Erica, and she's gone to the island. She's quite confused. She's in a state of grief, really. And what I love about the book is that you have a very light touch when it comes to Cohen. He's not the middle of the novel.
No. The thing about the year 1960, you know, the fact is that Leonard Cohen had gone to this island in order to write his first novel. So it seemed perfectly reasonable to me that he would be kind of shut away for quite a lot of the time. And that really suited my purposes, because I didn't, when I started, I was incredibly hamstrung. I'm an immense Leonard Cohen fan. I had this sort of feeling that, you know, I knew I would have to spend a lot of time on Idra. When I started thinking about I really wanted to write about Charmian Clift. That was what I wanted to do. And I felt, how am I going to do this? Well, maybe, you know, I mean, obviously I can't leave him out because he was there, but maybe, you know, given that he's writing his novel, he just walked past whistling occasionally. and this is particularly true because he was still alive. And in fact, you know, at one point I was thinking, I just can't do this. You know, I just don't know how I can put Leonard Cohen in my novel. And we went back to Idre, I think for the maybe the third time, in November 2016. And we were there when he died. And, you know, it was terribly sad, of course. But there was this other bit of me that thought, oh, well, that makes things much simpler because... because I'm never going to run into him now. Well, that's good. And then actually what I did, which I know this sounds sort of obsessive, but I decided that I wouldn't put words into his mouth. And so I started this a second piece of research where I tracked down every interview he'd ever done in... I made my parameter, really, that it had to be things that he'd done before he became a successful singer-songwriter. So things pre-67, 68, anything in that period was fine. And I found everything that he'd sort of said publicly, and I started to categorise them under various headings, you know, monogamy, women, writing. And I had a huge file of things that Leonard had actually said. And then I went through them and I made... sure that when Leonard was talking, that they were things that he'd actually said and not things that I was putting into his mouth. And so it gave me a sort of structure to each time Leonard appeared. I knew that, you know, what he might be talking about and the things that he was talking about were the things that he genuinely in real life did say around that time.
What an extraordinary piece of research. That really answers my next question, is about how you weave together fiction and real historical characters.
Yeah, I was just I really did nothing else for a few years other than immerse myself in that world. I spent a lot of time on Idre. I had a lot of lucky breaks. One of the first people I met on Idre happened in this same period, in that November 2016 trip. There was no one there. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny island with one tiny little town. I think there are 1,500 people on the island in total. And, you know, we were sort of sitting in our sort of lonely way out of season. And there was one man in this kind of one open restaurant. And we got chatting and he was half American, half Greek. What do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a writer. He said, oh, a writer used to live in my house. And I said, not Charmian Clift. And he nearly fell off his chair because at that point, you know, people on the whole hadn't heard of her. And when he heard what I was doing, he said, if you want to come and write your book in my house, I will, you know, I will go up. He lives part of the time in Athens. You can come and stay in my house and write your book. And that is indeed what I did. And it was sort of incredible to just be in the place, in the room where she and George Johnston wrote. And yeah, I kept waiting for her to appear. It was quite strange. I mean, she didn't. but it seems, was quite strange.
I mean, it seems like you could have been, I don't know, channeling her spirit or something.
Yeah, I feel very close to her. I still think about her a lot, actually. You know, often when you've, you know, it takes a while for your characters to leave your head when you've written a novel. But with this one, she's still in there. And I still find myself sort of conducting little conversations. Yeah, I mean, I still have enormous pleasure reading her words. They stayed a decade in Greece and then they went back to Australia, and she sadly died within 5 years of that. And, you know, she was deeply unhappy. But what she did do, because she had to support the family, because George Johnston at this point was terribly ill, was that she became amazingly Australia's best read woman columnist. And these weren't sort of tiny columns. These were sort of proper meaty essays where she took on, you know, great subjects, but a lot of it was sort of looking back on Greece. And there are three volumes of those essays, and they're always fascinating. And so I still read them. I still dip in and still find new things I didn't notice. And you know, she was very powerful. She did a lot of campaigning journalism. She did a lot of work campaigning against the lottery draft of young children. She was outspoken about things like abortion and women's rights to contraception. She was a sort of really marvellous person.
This book has also another element, which is music.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
So I Have Ghosts is the CD that goes alongside it. It's recorded by your husband and your daughter. Tell us more about that.
When I was writing the novel, you have these sort of strange moments that sound silly when you say them out loud, but I genuinely sort of was walking along one day and I was thinking about the next scene I was going to write. And my 18-year-old protagonist, Erica, was going to sort of, she's sort of in the book, she sort of plagues Charmian. She wants to know everything about Charmian. And she says to Charmian, "Do you believe in ghosts?" And as I was thinking about this, I absolutely heard in my head Charmian say, "Yes, I have ghosts, not all of them dead." And it just gave me a shiver. And that is indeed what Charmian says in my book. But I knew that as soon as I'd finished that I was going to write a lyric with that as its sort of main subject. And the lyric is actually, I mean, David sings it, but the song is from the point of view of Charmian. And he had just started recording it when lockdown happened. So he had a fiddle player had come in, I think. There'd been some early backing vocals, but they weren't right. And he had, you know, he'd had all sorts of people due to come in the studio and work on this song. And then, you know, no go. And with lockdown, my daughter, our daughter, who is 18, but was 17 at the beginning of lockdown, had just taken up playing the harp. And amazingly, I mean, she just really, really picked up the harp incredibly fast. And when we started doing the Von Trapped events, she would play the intro on the harp, which was a line from this song, "Yes, I Have Ghosts." And the other thing that happened during lockdown was, although, you know, we've always sung as a family and things, was we started to realise that Romany is my daughter's name. Romany and David have this incredible blend. And I don't know why we'd never noticed this before, but I suppose once you're down to, you know, the only tools you have are actually your children. Suddenly, you know, she was promoted to absolutely the person who was going to sing this song with him. And, you know, her ambitions lie in other directions, but she very sweetly, you know, agreed to do all of these things. And so, in fact, the single now is, or the track, is Romany and David singing together and Romany playing the harp. And it's really beautiful.
And how can people hear that?
It's available. It's on, I guess it's on iTunes and Spotify.
Right. Is it within a sort of audiobook though as well?
Oh, that's right. Yes. It's so the other thing that happened was that the actress, Rachel Sterling, who had been booked by the audiobook company to record A Theatre for Dreamers, she couldn't do it. And the audiobook company, you know, really wanted to get the audiobook out. So David said, "Oh, well, I've got a studio, and why don't you do it?" And I thought, "Oh God, really? Okay." And so David turned producer, and then he, you know, he never lets anything alone. He said, "Well, you know, I could do some music between chapters. I'd love to do that." And so he did that. And so the audiobook is, you know, has the single at the end, and it has these wonderful pieces of music between the chapters. And and apparently that hadn't been done much before. I mean, I think someone did a piece in the Times kind of saying that it was I don't believe it was the first time. I'm sure that other people have done this, but apparently, you know, it was quite innovative. But it seems like a terribly good idea to have a little bit of music. I mean, you know, if you've listened to things on the radio, they often have music. And I think it works really well.
It certainly does. And the whole book does, the whole project. And I should just tell the listeners that they can watch back some of your Von Trapp family, I think, on Facebook.
It's on YouTube.
YouTube.
I think, yeah, they're all on YouTube. And I looked at one the other day. They're quite charming,
no,
actually.
They really are. And of course, the paperback has now been released and the audiobook is out there. And it's absolutely, not only because we can't all go off to Greece now and nobody's going to get a summer holiday in all likelihood, but it's just a stunning work of literature. Polly Sampson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
A Theatre for Dreamers is published by Bloomsbury and the paperback comes out on April the 15th. It's written by the wonderful Polly Sampson. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer-Court. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.